From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
With Governor Jerry Brown termed out in 2018, the race is already on to replace him. Two former big city mayors, former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom and former LA Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, have already declared. But one of the early surprises has been the strength of another candidate for governor, State Treasurer John Chung. What would be the goals of a Governor Chung administration? And more importantly, how would he go about accomplishing those goals? A discussion with candidate for governor, State Treasurer John Chung.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. As well as support from Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Wheeland, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Governor Jerry Brown is termed out in 2018. Among those who'd like to replace him is our guest, State Treasurer John Chung. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, so tell us, why do you want to be governor?
Well, this state is one of exceptional people, exceptional achievement, and I want to make sure that we continue on that pathway. So my background, the only person to serve in all three funding and finance offices for the state, giving us a strong and working on building a strong financial foundation to do the aspirational work. How do we provide world-class education? How do we build more affordable housing? How do we create the jobs of the 21st century? How do we invest in people's future? So I think I bring that best expertise to make sure that that dream is possible for all Californians.
It all comes down to money. And you've been doing this for a while. So may I call you John?
Yes, please.
So John, let me ask you this. How do you make that vision a reality? I mean, it really is, all this costs money. Where are you going to find it?
Well, you have to be smart. I think I've demonstrated that. When we had the financial crisis in 2009, I was the state elected official who stood up to the institutions, both the former governor and to the legislature controlled by members of my party.
And what did Governor Schwarzenegger try to do in 2009 that you stood up to?
Well, the governor wanted to pay the public servants of California federal minimum wage, right? That was a time of great recession. The mm-hmm. state lost 1.3 million jobs. You know, the good workers here in Fresno and elsewhere, why would you want to pay them federal minimum wage? How are they going to pay for their health care? How are they going to pay for their transportation? How are they going to pay for the clothes on their kids' back? How are they going to pay for, rent or a mortgage? You don't do that to good, hardworking Californians.
That got you a big profile in 2009 when that happened.
Well, most importantly, it was the right thing to do.
So go on with your ideas in terms of how do you make this vision a reality in terms of finances? I mean, people don't like taxes. A lot of people think, oh, just fraud, waste, and abuse, we can save money that way. And there is some savings there, but it's not enough to pay for some of the bigger ideas.
Well, we're going to have to be smart about it. And so part of that is the identifying fraud, waste, and abuse. As the state controller, I was the most successful auditor in California history. I identified about $9.5 billion of waste. But part of that is the lessons learned from that. You know, what do we do in regards to better practices in regards to healthcare? A lot of inefficiencies, a lot of waste, right? So let's quit wasting that money, and you can provide additional services. Not everything you need, but getting doing things in a much better way. Audited the redevelopment agencies, right, because there was waste there. I want to bring those back, but we need local governments to have the economic development tools so that they can grow their economies, local economies, to make sure that they have a tool for building more affordable housing.
You know, it was interesting, you know, back in the day when you were doing this, the state was undergoing tremendous, it was a recession, and the deficits were huge, a $20 billion kind of deficits. Things have certainly changed.
Well, we deferred payments to education by $10 billion. And that's why I told the legislature and governor, get the numbers right, because you have kids who are going to schools that are in terrible condition, right? Teachers are getting pink slips. Morale is terrible. So you need somebody who's going to be smart, who's going to be an adult in the room to say, we got to come together to make the difficult decisions. Everyday Californians make tough decisions, and their legislative and executive branch leadership needs to do the same thing.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, you're running against two, your main opponents seem to be two Democratic former mayors, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom and former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. You've described them as stylish and suggesting that you're more of a workhorse than a show horse. So what about your specific leadership style distinguishes you from them?
Yeah, I think passion, advocacy, energy. Look at the issues and who are working on them today. Right, as you interview me, I've been pushing very aggressively for the past 3 weeks to get the legislature to up the bond to build more affordable housing. Right, I'm not talking about as governor I'm going to do this. I'm doing it today. As the state treasurer, I've increased in my first 2.5 years building affordable housing by 80%. Right, that's the leadership that people want today. I can go into communities throughout the state of California say, I'm not going to promise you. Look, you have a roof over your head today because I pushed aggressively as your state treasurer.
You know, another thing I want to ask you is, you know, it's widely acknowledged that California really is a tale of two states. You know, the coastal areas or urban areas are doing quite well. The inland areas, not so much when it comes to poverty, unemployment, crime, educational attainment, health outcomes, air quality, water quality. How do you address that disparity?
Yeah, that's absolutely unacceptable, right? In the world's sixth largest economy, we've made great progress. But, you know, a statement about who we are and our vision and our hopes, we have to make sure that everybody's included. I believe I was the first state elected official to do free income taxes for middle income and low income folks. As governor, I want to make sure that everybody gets those services. And when I was in controller, my previous position, right, I did not leave the Central Valley abandoned. I had my staff come up here. If you worked for me and you had public interaction, you had to be tax trained. I wanted to make sure that local individuals and communities got that type of assistance. What do we do in regards to helping train them to understand the tax and finance laws for the entrepreneurs? Right, we have a lot of young, bright people engaged in technology in the Central Valley, a lot of agricultural technology. How do we help them become successful?
Okay, well, up next, we're going to talk about some of the hot-button issues in California today. You mentioned one of them earlier, affordable housing. We're also going to talk about adequate infrastructure. You can think roads and water on that one. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. My name is Mark Kepler. I'm with the Maddie Institute, and we're talking with State Treasurer John Chung, candidate for governor, about some current issues the state's dealing with. First big issue we already mentioned earlier was affordable housing. Seems to be a basic issue there of whether the state government should spend more money to address the problem with bonds or tax credits. You mentioned RDAs, redevelopment agencies, or should the government focus on regulatory reform, things like amending CEQA, the environmental law. What do you think?
So the answer is yes. We have to do
it. I thought you might say both.
It requires everything. Right. There is no single magical solution that addresses the complexity of affordable housing. We know that rural housing issues can be oftentimes very different than urban or suburban housing. So we need all of the above approach to address these types of issues. So yes, redevelopment agencies, giving the tools for local governments. Yes, more bond capacity to make sure that we address the backlog. We're 1.5 million units short in our great state. Yes, we need to move these projects along faster to, you know, try to bring local government officials and their local homeowners to say we do need to make sure that we take care of our kids and teachers.
I'm sorry, you're talking about the bond issue. What are your thoughts are in terms of how large that bond should be, that bond package?
So it's at $3 billion. We think we're going to make progress on that. But if we can get to 6 to 9, that would be a huge win, right? But anything in between, as long as we continue to make progress, we can't continue to slow down our economy to put up these barriers by not having insufficient housing. Anywhere you go in this state, you hear from the big corporations and local business owners, we can't hire people because housing's just too inaccessible.
Yeah, it's particularly affecting the lower middle-income people because actually those are the ones that are leaving the state. Rich people are moving in, but it's the middle and lower-income people that are moving out because they can't afford the housing. And the LAO, Legislative Analyst Office, did a report, and they found that if you're trying to take care of the 1.7 million poorest people so they can afford homes, you're going to have to spend $15 to $30 billion a year. So it ain't just money alone. It's also maybe regulatory reform as well, as you mentioned.
Yes.
You know, there was a report that you received about $100,000 in campaign contributions from developers over the years for bond financing on a committee that you're involved with. And I want to make clear there's no evidence of any quid pro quo, any corruption, anything like that. But are you concerned about the mere appearance of a conflict that might undermine your credibility in some way?
Yeah, as you pointed out, that story is untrue and irresponsible, right? There is no evidence because that is, in fact, a false story. I've been pushing aggressively for the last 10 years to build more affordable housing. Yes, I've been an advocate, so there are some developers who do support me. But the nonprofit communities, I have a whole bunch of people who are very passionate about this particular issue. I sit on authority where there's three members. The votes for the last 2.5 years have been 100% where the governor's representative, the controller, and I voted the same.
Unanimous?
Yeah, so we followed staff recommendation. Am I supposed to vote against staff recommendation?
Right. Okay, so our viewers and listeners understand, so it comes to you as a recommendation from staff.
Yes.
And then you basically just have approved what staff have suggested.
Right, and it's a scoring system, right? So if you do this, you get a point, right? So if you do purple pipes, you get a point. If you build, you know, facilities for children.
No, you're already proving you're a policy wonk by saying the word purple pipe. Because most people are like, okay, but what does that mean? That means repurposed water for median islands and parks and things of that nature.
To better use water.
Right. So let's talk about highways and roads for a second. Another major infrastructure issue for California, seems to be that we have a car culture here. People like driving on roads or highways. What's your position on that new $5.2 billion transportation tax?
I supported it. We need the money for infrastructure. I know it can be so hard for so many people who are trying to make it, the additional tax, right? But it's infrastructure is critical for this state. We have to make sure that we have good highways, but it impacts quality of life. We don't want trucks stalled because there's massive potholes on the street. We don't want individuals stuck because there's too much congestion. We want parents to get home to take their kids to their soccer matches.
But a lot of this is for maintenance and rehabilitation,
yes.
Not so much for expansion.
Yes. So
what about mass transit, taking some of those people out of their cars, perhaps, in the right situations? What are your feelings about mass transit? And maybe high-speed rail. What are your thoughts on that?
And so I support it. The gas tax also goes for mass transit. It also goes to upgrade and protect 500 bridges in this state. We don't want that to revisit that disaster of Minneapolis from a couple decades ago where you had
the bridge collapsed
and people died.
Yeah. Another infrastructure issue, the perennial issue of water, never goes away. So, a lot of places were devastated by the drought, particularly places like the Central Valley. So do you support more dams? If so, where?
I think we have to be open to surface storage, right? We want to make sure that we have it, use it effectively. So whether we're looking at, Northern California, Central Valley, whether we do upgrades so that you don't have the runoff like San Luis Reservoir, we don't want to see that type of waste. So how do we prioritize that type of infrastructure, including surface storage?
Well, I have to ask you about the Delta Plan. The governor's what's called the California Water Fix, $17 billion Delta Plan. Where are you on that?
I think there's a process underway, right? You had the scientific review, right? The part of it is there's going to be a conversation, and there's going to be some plans coming forward next month as to how you pay for all of that. Let's take in all the data. Let's see if we can balance the concerns. Let's try to get responsible people to the table and see what's best.
Okay. So where does the state treasurer and gubernatorial candidate John Chung stand on other perennial issues such as crime, poverty, jobs, and education? We're going to have that conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So let's talk about an issue that seems to be uppermost in the voters' minds when it comes to what government should do. That's public safety. Long-term crime trends in California are actually down, but there's been recent uptick in some crime statistics. So is this a one-off anomaly, or is this something more?
So we need to research it. Obviously, we passed a couple of major revisions to California's criminal justice program, and so we have to see
a pretty significant shift. I mean, it went from kind of this throw everybody in jail, frankly, the three strikes thing, to a difference starting in 2010 with realignment and those kinds of things. Pretty big change.
Yeah. So as with any public policy, we should monitor and see what the actual community effects are, right? And is there a causal relationship, or is this something that's correlational?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You read the PolitiFact or the LAO, and they say, well, there are blips. These things go up and down. You can't really make a decision based on a one-year blip. You got to see if the trend emerges. And so I guess that's one thing we're going to have to look at. You know,
you would know. You're in public policy. You're researching it.
The Public Policy Institute of California says that almost 4 in 10 Californians live at or near poverty. And actually, those rates are actually higher in places like the Central Valley. And the thing that's interesting about that is that may actually get worse as baby boomers retire, because a lot of them don't have retirement income. So there's been this thing called Secure Choice, which is an idea to create a state-administered pension plan for private employees. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a huge advocate. I chair the board. So the last year, I went back to the White House with our Senate President Pro Tem, lobbied our senators, lobbied members of Congress and the Department of Labor so that we could try to make sure that this plan is effective in state. You have 7.34 million Californians who work, but they don't have any type of retirement security. And so we wanted to make it easier for employers who don't have a type of plan for them to tell their employees or share with their employees that this plan is available. And so we wanted to make sure that the 6.8 million Californians who qualify for this particular program can understand it if they choose to participate, provide them with a pathway to save money so that they could have a golden future.
Are you worried at all about liability for the state on this?
So there is no state liability, right? This isn't like some of the other plans. This is sort of like an IRA. So the state's not liable for your individual IRA. The state wouldn't be liable for this program.
I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but they say that if you have a situation where the people are already in the program but have to opt out, much higher usage rates than if you have to have someone opt in. Has that been thought about at all?
Yeah, so it's right. When you opt out, there's as you've just pointed out, there's huge great numbers who choose to participate. Part of this, the positive attributes of this program is that we've simplified the program for individuals. There are so many financial products. It's intimidating for so many people. They don't know what the management or the administrative fees are, so we've tried to simplify it for people.
Right. I actually, when I first started, I had all my money in the bank, and my brother was saying, "What are you doing? You're not making any money in the stock market." I don't know how the stock market works, so I was unsure. Finally, I did, so that's a good thing. It's actually Fidelity, I think I read recently, came out with a report that the average Fidelity investor has only $100,000 saved for retirement. And if you think about the cost of living in California, it's not going to go very far.
Yeah, they used to, I don't want to get too technical, but the old 4% rule, it wouldn't go very far.
Right, right. So let's talk about this two-tier economy that seems to exist in California. We talked a little about it earlier. You know, unemployment rates in the San Joaquin Valley are twice as high as those in the Bay Area. Indeed, 8 of the 10 metro areas in the nation with the worst unemployment are in California. What needs to be done to correct that economic imbalance?
Education, housing, jobs. So we talked about housing, so we don't have to revisit that conversation. But we need to make sure that we have jobs that are more expansive, more inclusive for individuals. What's different about my work versus others, I'm already working on investing in jobs here in the Central Valley. As the state treasurer, I chair 12 different economic development authorities. We're trying to bring clean and green jobs. We're trying to make it better for financing for agricultural. I've done a lot of work internationally trying to there's interested people from Asia who are interested in buying more products from the Central Valley. So bringing those connections and creating greater economic opportunities. And then education. Clearly, every child needs to get a world-class education, right? They will hit a ceiling that is very low unless they get access to the skills, the knowledge, the people who will help them succeed.
You know, it's interesting, an electric car company manufacturer just opened up a facility in Hanford in the Central Valley, which is really kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I had worked with them.
Yeah, so it's so the green jobs might be a way out for some regions. So we were talking about education. I want to talk to you about a little bit about that. We all agree that the future success of the state really is dependent on all students being successful. And so how do we ensure that historically underserved students, like the Latino students that make up more than half of California's public schools, or those $1.4 million English learners, are prepared for the 21st century?
So we're going to have to first work with our local representatives and having them articulate much louder, because there's concerns back about Washington, D.C. removing funding for programs, especially for lower-income individuals under Title I. Number two, when I challenge the legislature and governor, it's about consistent budgeting, right? You can have the volatility, especially the poor districts that have less financial wherewithal, right? They are the ones that are most impacted.
And then do you think the local control funding formula is a good idea?
It's a good start. I want to make sure we make appropriate adjustments, especially for kids with special needs. A lot of people don't care about those who have some of the larger challenges, and it hurts a lot of the school districts who have to provide the services and programs to assist kids with special needs.
We're covering a lot of ground. We're going to cover a little more ground in a moment when we talk with gubernatorial candidate John Chung. In that conversation in a moment, this is the Mattie Report. Welcome back to the Mattie Report. My name is Mark Kepler. I'm with the Mattie Institute. We're talking with California gubernatorial candidate, State Treasurer John Chung, about some of the long-term issues he's likely to confront if he's elected governor of California. One of them is immigration, big issue. What's your position on sanctuary cities, schools, state?
Well, I'm a huge believer in immigration, right? But we have to make sure that we have smart, sound immigration policies. We have to make sure that we protect the rights of those who are doing the right thing, but we also have to have a proper balance of public safety.
Let me ask you this. This is a federal issue, so you really wouldn't be dealing with it as governor, but what are your thoughts on immigration quotas? Should we decide who gets into the United States?
Well, in a sense, we set the criteria of but as long as we have a balanced approach, right? I know they're talking about, those who come who are very wealthy, but we also have it here in the heartland of the state of California. Those who don't necessarily have a lot of wealth, but who are making massive contributions. You're not going to have a millionaire work the fields.
You think about some of the immigrants that have come to the Valley over the years, Armenians, Mexicans, add a lot of value to the economy.
Massive value.
Yeah, so let me ask you another big issue. It's healthcare. I'm hitting you with all the big issues. There's some talk about, how do we control the escalating cost of healthcare? There's also some discussion about how do we make sure there's even access, because it's very uneven in the state. What's your prescription to fix what ails California's healthcare system?
Well, I've been working on it today. We know that there's great concern with the federal government possibly removing some of those funds. One of the things that I did in the first half of this calendar year is to work on trying to provide some sources of funding for community clinics. That would impact Fresno and the surrounding region. One in every seven Californians gets their health care from a community clinic, and because those clinics are in financial peril under a current president's administration, we have to make sure that we preserve that access. And then, how are we smarter with the financing? Tackling the inefficiencies, tackling overpriced pharmaceuticals, better delivery of services to reduce the cost.
Yeah, medical technology might be a way to really reduce the cost there. If we can just, take those records and computerize them instead of just by hand and stuff. But I want to ask also about single payer. It's a big issue.
Yes.
Where are you on single payer?
So I think it's a great idea. My parents come from a country where they have it, so it's very popular. But they also have cost control issues. So we have to be smart because we want to make sure that we can pay for this system. But if we're going to drive out a lot of those inefficiencies, other types of costs, single payer, if Medicare for all those types of ideas are positive ideas.
Yeah, it seems like you just look around the world, see what systems work, and then kind of do a, best practices and apply something here. But that's a huge issue.
We pay the most and get mediocre results.
And people are very surprised by that, that we pay about twice as much per person compared to other similarly developed countries. Yet our health outcomes, when it talks about mortality and those kinds of things, are they're not top like people think they are. Let me kind of switch gears a little bit. Climate change. Over 97% of all actively publishing climate scientists, according to NASA, agree that climate warming trends are due to human activities. It's by the way, I found it interesting. Only 94% of all scientists think that smoking will cause cancer. So this is actually higher than that. I thought it was kind of interesting. But studies also report that California produces only about 1% of all global emissions. So how do you balance dealing with the issue of climate change, but also not harming the California economy in the process?
We have to do both, right? So we can continue to grow the economy. Right? We have 500,000 jobs that are tied to it. So we're putting us on the proper pathway to address these issues. We're the state that's going to be impacted by sea level rise, so I pushed for legislation to make sure we monitor it. And then I'm pushing today for green bonds. How do we finance growing the economy? How do we finance cleaner infrastructure? What we can use for water? What we can do for you know, smart roadways that when you think about autonomous vehicles or electrical vehicles. So we can be smart about it and balance both economic growth and environmental considerations.
Any concern about Bakersfield? I mean, it's a big oil, Kern County, big oil place. Concern about what impact it may have on them?
Yeah, it's obviously going to have some challenges, especially to people of color. So we're going to have to find a balance where what other types of economic growth activities we can create in areas that will be impacted with the change with fossil fuels.
Let me ask this last question, and that's on unfunded liability when it comes to public employee pensions. And the other issue that's not even talked about is public employee retirement costs. Is the state going to be able to meet those obligations?
So I think I've been the one state elected official who's spoken about it consistently for the last 10 years, right? In my first year as the controller, I said, let's study that OPEB and how much it's going to cost. And when I did that first year study, it would cost us $32 billion, the taxpayers of California. Today, that obligation is $76 billion. I pushed aggressively to say the state needs to start paying all of its bills on a timely basis.
Now, let's just put that in context. So $72 billion, how large is the state budget?
$76 billion. So the general fund budget is about $125 billion. And
so it just shows you how big that liability is.
Yeah. And the overall budget's over $180 billion.
Right. So it's a big issue, and that's something you're going to be looking at, would be addressing?
I pushed for it, and the governor has taken positive action on it.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to thank State Treasurer and California gubernatorial candidate John Chung for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
So what does the future hold for California's economy? Will water be a factor? What about education? And if we fail to provide a viable economic future, what does it mean for our criminal justice system? We'll ask the experts from the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, Sarah Bone, Alvar Escriva-Bow, Paul Warren, Magnus Lofstrom, and Brandon Martin.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Recently, California experienced some strong job growth and low unemployment, but many Californians may feel that that's not really happening for them because their family median incomes continue to lag or economic disparities persist. What is California's economic forecast? Is it sunny or cloudy? We're fortunate to be joined by Sarah Bone, a research fellow with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. Answer some of those questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
So the numbers indicate economies are performing pretty well. State unemployment rate is near a 30-year low. Job growth has outpaced the nation's for 5 years straight. What's the problem?
You're right, Mark. We are in one of the longest economic growth periods that we've seen in the last 30 to 40 years. It's great news. That's based on statewide economic measures. Okay. But I think when you look a little bit more closely, you discover a much more varied picture with some nuances that are important. For example, there are disparities across California's regions, across California's industries, where not all are performing as well as others. And then when you look beyond just kind of the unemployment rate at the people who are not even looking for work, so they're not included in the measure, there's a much more kind of difficult picture that you see. There are almost as many people who are able to work but are not even looking for work because maybe they're discouraged about their opportunities as there are unemployed people in California.
You can almost take that unemployment number and double it. The growth in California's labor market, is it following historical trends?
I would say overall that's correct. You know, our jobs and unemployment kind of ebb and flow with recessions and recoveries, and we tend to swing a bit more than the U.S. That's been true of the last 10 years or so. But like I said, we're now in one of the longest growth periods that we've ever seen in the past at least 30, 40 years. And so unless something is really different about today, which we're not seeing signs of, we don't really expect that growth to continue. And then the other thing that's a little different from historical trends is that more people are actually out of the labor force than historically. So Part of that is due to the aging population, right. Just fewer people are participating in the labor force. But part of it is due to this disconnection, like I mentioned, between, you know, not having the job prospects right. match up with kind of the
and
skills.
And some of you give up, you look so long and you say, forget it, I can't find a job.
Right.
You know, you were talking earlier, the overall economy is improving, but there's the economic indicators are uneven. And so you mm-hmm. were talking about some areas, geographic areas, and also industries that are missing out. Can you go a little more detail into that?
Sure. There are these persistent differences that are not really different than we've seen historically, but nonetheless point to kind of different experiences that people have across the state. So the Bay Area, Orange County, San Diego have really lowest unemployment rates in the state. It's about double that in the Central Valley. Although in the past year, actually job growth in a lot of Central California, including some Central Valley counties, has really outpaced the state, which is good news, mm-hmm. I think, for kind of economic prospects
right.
widening.
Do you have a reason for attributing? Why is that?
Well, I think they were kind of slower to catch up. The Bay Area and San Diego in particular kind of were the fastest to kind of recover from the recession, and it's now kind of trickling down, I think.
And what about the industries like, you know, construction right. versus services versus manufacturing? How was the difference there?
So the service sector is really what led us out of the recession and continues to be the kind of engine of job growth.
Okay.
And construction has picked up as well, so they're growing jobs at a really fast pace. This is kind of where our declines in unemployment and job growth is coming from. Manufacturing continues to kind of lag behind, and over the next 10 years, we think that will continue.
It's interesting. In manufacturing, people think it's going to come back, but it's been going on a downward slide for a while.
Many decades.
It'd be interesting to see if there's more money spent on defense spending. California's typically benefited from that. We'll see if it happens in the future, but that could possibly change that, but that's a kind of a wait and see.
Right.
So let me ask you this. So looking ahead, what are the prospects, the economic prospects for the average Californian?
That's a great question. I mean, when you look at income numbers, like you mentioned at the beginning, the middle family in California, that kind of average Californian, in terms of their income, is still doing a little bit worse than they were about 10 years ago. It's been improving, and so that's good news. And we think that's probably likely to continue, at least in the short term, because the job market is tightening and wages have finally started to go up. But, you know, as we talked about these disparities in economic opportunities across regions, industries, and workers is really kind of what I think we need to focus on for increasing the prospects for the average Californian, just making sure that they have the skills and training that's required of the jobs of today and tomorrow. And that's really where, you know, individuals, employers, educators and policymakers really need to work together to make sure we have that kind of skilled workforce that the economy demands.
So I just want to end very quickly with this. So education, big deal, right?
Big deal.
I'm assuming.
Right.
Okay. Want to thank that forecast for the California economy. Up next, we're going to take a closer look at some environmental factors that are driving at least the Valley's economic growth, and that is water. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. There's no question that California has made some progress on water management recently, but more needs to be done given the increase in population growth and the issue of climate change. What are the challenges and what are the trade-offs? We're talking with Alvar Esquiva-Bow, an environmental expert with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thanks, Mark.
So it seems like water is always a topic of conversation in California. It's become more so during the drought. What are some of the strengths and weaknesses that were revealed during the recent drought?
Mm-hmm. It's always too little or too much.
Right, exactly. The drought has, get it just right.
The drought has not significantly affected California's overall economy. It's this one main point that we want to make. And this is because cities were doing really well during, benefiting from past investments and also from water conservation. On the other hand, we have that many small, poor, rural communities, especially in the Central Valley, have lost drinking water supplies as their wells went dry.
Right, a lot of groundwater pumping, and all of a sudden, you know, their wells that they're using for their drinking water are either contaminated or run dry.
Yeah, so. And that's a really sad story that we have to address. On the agricultural side, and to avoid major losses, we have seen that groundwater has been over-depleted. And we will never recover for some of this overuse. So we are creating additional problems on land sinking and also, you know,
subsidence
wells.
Where the land actually sinks because the water, you take the water up and the land just collapses.
Wells are also going dry, as we said. Finally, the drought has also stressed the state's rivers, forests, and wetlands. So we have many, many issues that we have seen during
I think one of the things you really saw as the drought was the increase in groundwater pumping.
Yeah.
And as a lot of people have said, it's really unsustainable. You can't maintain at those levels. Though, the truth is that when you do have droughts, it's not unusual to do groundwater pumping.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably should. It's just that the volume,
because
it's a pretty severe drought, it was a problem. You know, 25 million Californians and 3 million acres of farmland rely on water from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Yet the inability of the Delta's levees is a major concern. Yeah. What needs to be done there?
Yeah. You know, out of the many thousand miles of levees that we have in California, the Delta levees are the least reliable. So, and they are under
threat. That doesn't make you feel good, does it?
No, of course not. They are under threat because sea level rise, we have continued sinking of the islands, and also earthquakes that can come every day, you know. And the Delta Stewardship Council has begun to develop a plan that will prioritize state investments in levees. You know, there's a draft now under review, and it's expected to be adopted later this year. The bad news is that it will be very costly, you know, and potentially...
There's a lot of levees in the Delta.
There's a lot of levees and can be controversial and also difficult to implement.
It's interesting, though. You think, the levees, they were built, you know, by the Army Corps of Engineers or something, and you know, they're fine, but they're not. They could collapse in a big earthquake.
Yeah, and you know what? This plan of the Delta Stewardship Council has, as I said, more than $2 billion in high priority investments. So we'll need to assess what can we do with likely resources and what's achievable.
Okay, so your report indicates that California has just begun to really deal with extreme flood risks. Where is California falling short and what needs to be done?
Yeah, you know, one in five residents in California live in areas with significant flood risk.
20% of Californians live in like a flood, potential flood area.
Yes.
Wow.
So we need to limit people living in flood-prone areas by coordinating city planning and flood management. That's essential. And also consider future conditions when approving new development.
It's amazing that they have approved development where there is, where it could possibly flood. You think that would be, frankly, a no-brainer.
Yeah. And finally, we also have to consider climate change. It's likely to bring new flooding events in coastal areas, so we have to adapt for that.
Right, more precipitation as opposed to snowpack, and so even exacerbates that problem.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. You know, your report that local agencies raise almost $30 billion annually for California's water sector. But in spite of that, $30 billion, in spite of that, you're saying there's critical funding gaps. What are they and what needs to be done to close those gaps?
There are three. The three largest gaps are managing floods, stormwater, and ecosystems. We assessed in that report in 2014 that more than $2 billion per year are needed $2 billion per year. There's another smaller but really important gap, and this safe drinking water. We need to provide water for these small communities that doesn't have access to economies of scale for drinking for cleaning their drinking supplies. But California has relied too much in bonds, so to fund most of these needs that are kind of chronically underfunded. And we cannot provide once at a time funds to things that are
so chronical. How do we pay for it?
So we need broader and more reliable mix of funding sources, like including new fees and taxes or to fill these
people
gaps.
Are going to love hearing that.
Yeah. No, but we need that.
Yeah, but the reality is you've got to pay for it somehow. It's either pay me now or pay me later.
Yeah.
It sounds like the cost of water is high. Wait till you don't have water, then you realize what the cost is really going to be. Well, no doubt California is going to still be dealing with water. It's a perpetual issue here. Thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we're going to take a closer look at a key driver for the state's economic growth, education. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. What about public school districts throughout California? They're adjusting to some pretty major changes in the way K-12 education is delivered, assessed, and funded. How are they doing? And what about California's growing shortage of college-educated workers? What will that mean to the state's economy if we can't improve college graduation rates? Our guest is Paul Warren, an expert in education matters with the Public Policy Institute of California. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thanks for having me.
So, some pretty significant changes in K-12 education in the last few years. Can you explain some of those big changes?
Sure. There's been a lot going on. The state adopted new Common Core standards. That defines what students should know in each class and each subject area. And there are some pretty major changes brought by that. It really changes what teachers do in the classroom every day. Second thing the state did was created the local control funding formula, which funds districts, and it really increased funding for students who are low income or English learner students, those who don't speak English.
It's almost like a block grant. They give the districts money and say, you spend it. Before, they used to have a thing called categoricals.
That's right.
Where they would say, here's the money, but here's how you have to spend it. That's not the case anymore.
That's right. So schools have a lot more leeway in figuring out how they want to address problems at the local level. It also came along with the new accountability system, which we used to have accountability just based on test scores. Now it's based on five or six different measures, including graduation rates, attendance, and those kinds of
things. How is this impacting scores? Has it had a positive impact in improving scores by California students?
So we've only had 2 years of testing with the new standards, but scores did go up quite a bit in 2016, that is last spring. And, you know, it's certainly an indication that Common Core implementation is moving along well, but it's too early to know about some of these other reforms.
Okay, so like, say, local control funding formula, I think you said it's a little uneven the way that's been rolled out in terms of local control funding formula. What districts are doing with their LCAPs is something called a local control and accountability plan. Some districts taking it very seriously, others not so much.
Yes, that's right. They're very complicated documents, and not all schools really know how to use these to maximum benefit. And some districts are doing a really bang-up job with them, and some are still really trying to figure it out.
Okay, so what about the financial picture of K-12 education? Gotten better?
It's gotten much better with the recession being over and the state climbing out and tax revenues.
So we're done, right?
Well, there's still a couple of challenges. We just issued a report on special ed and found that that funding for special ed hasn't increased much over the last few years, while the number of children with very severe expensive disabilities has gone up quite a bit. So there's a need for more money there. Also, I think just in general, Californians believe that schools are underfunded.
What do you think needs to be done overall to make sure that California's children are really prepared for the future when it comes to K-12 education?
Well, so there's a few things. One is funding. Another is making sure that schools and districts get the help they need in improving the classes for kids, and particularly for low-income and the English learner kids. Those are our future. You know, low-income students represent about 60% of all students in the state. And if those students aren't learning and achieving at high levels, then we have a problem.
I think improving education is like the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So if you work on that, focus on that weakest link, then you can improve education overall. Let me switch gears a little and talk for about a minute or so about higher education. It's reported that California is woefully short of the number of college grads it's going to need in the next 10 to 20 years. What's going on there?
Yeah, we published a report that looks at that issue, and we found that the state will need more than a million students by 2030, more than what we think they'll actually produce.
Okay.
And what's underlying that are two things. One is that the baby boomer generation is retiring, like me.
Yeah, we're all highly educated, right?
Well, actually, you know, our group is more educated than in the past. Mm-hmm. And so you have to replace us in the market. Right. The second thing is that the kids who are coming up through high school now aren't graduating from college at the same rates. And part of that has to do with not being prepared for college when they come out of high school. And others just struggle to get through the 4 years.
Yeah, the 4 years used to be a thing for you and I that was pretty common, but now it's 6 years or even longer.
Yes.
So what can be done to improve the situation in terms of higher education?
Well, making sure that students are prepared for college, that is, they have the math and the English skills they need to be successful in college is one thing, and you know, our LCFF looks at those kinds of data in terms of assessing schools and districts. Another thing is that the colleges themselves can do a better job of figuring out how to take kids who maybe not weak, or real strong in one of those areas, and helping them boost their skills and then move on and actually go on to
I think year. Everyone will benefit. Investing in education is probably a pretty good idea. Thank you for that conversation. Up next, more on California's future with the experts from the Public Policy Institute of California. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. You know, a lack of education and a job can lead to a life of crime. Recently, California's made some historic changes in its correction system. What impact have those changes had on the state, county, and community levels? We'll ask our guests, Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin from the PPIC. So, Magnus, let me start with you first. The California prison population experienced a lot of growth between 1980 and 2006, 700% increase. Due to kind of the tough-on-crime policy that the state had. In the last 10 years, however, the prison population has declined rather dramatically. Why the change?
Well, you're right. There was an explosive growth in the prison population over that period, and we added a lot of prisons. We went from 11 to 33 over that period of time. But even with that essential tripling of the capacity, that wasn't enough to keep up with the population growth. And by 2006, our prisons housed about twice as many inmates as they were designed to be.
We're stacking inmates in prisons.
That's right. The bunk beds were everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was really poor conditions, as you'd expect with that kind of crowding. And the state was sued over these poor prison conditions. And essentially, what was claimed was that they weren't providing adequate health and mental health care to the inmate population. And as a result of these lawsuits, in 2007, a three-judge federal panel was appointed. And 2 years later, in 2009, they ruled that, yes, overcrowding is really the fundamental problem in our prison system that prevents the state from improving conditions. And they ordered the state to reduce the prison population.
Yeah, the state really had no other choice there. They either reduce them or it's contempt of court. The court's going to force it, right?
Yes, it's a federal court mandate here, and it was to reduce it down to 137.5% of the design capacity.
So just into it for a second. So they're not saying just 100% of design capacity. They'll allow you to go above that, 37.5%.
Right.
Even then, California had a struggle getting it down to that number.
Oh, absolutely. But it was a big change. That was at that time in 2009, with the capacity that we had at that time, that meant that we had to reduce the prison population by about 41,000 inmates. That's big.
That's a lot of people.
And we did go on a path to actually address that. We implemented a number of measures and reform since 2009. And since that time, we've reduced the prison population by about 41,000.
Well, let's talk about, Brandon, let's talk about some of those ways the state went about reducing the prison and parole populations. What did they do?
Sure. In 2009, the state enacted Senate Bill 678. Which created incentives for local probation departments in the counties to decrease the failure of their felony probationers. If they failed, they would normally be sent to state prison. Right. This created an incentive to decrease that sort of number.
And by the way, just as a footnote here for our audience, there's a difference between a state prison and a county jail.
Right.
They're actually very, they're distinct.
Two different systems.
It's not a state jail, it's a state prison.
Yes, correct. Okay. And then in 2011, the state enacted Assembly Bill 109, or what we commonly call public safety realignment or realignment. And this was a sort of large shift in the supervision of non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual offenders from the state to the county sheriff and probation departments.
I'm assuming a lot of those were drug offenses, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay. So we got Prop 47, and we got the realignment.
Yep.
Did they simply shift those inmates from state prison to county jails?
That's a great question. So if you look after realignment went into effect in the first year, the prison population decreases by about 27,000, but at the same time, the jail population is increasing by about 9,000. And so on net, there were 18,000 less inmates in state prison or county jail. And so there was an overall decrease.
So they're what they're doing now. They're not just letting them go free. They're doing electronic monitoring and those other methods.
Yeah. So counties have adapted to that increase by releasing people, but on various types of programs.
All right. So community service. I was reading your report. Day reporting, alternative work. I mean, there are things that they're doing. They're just not in jail.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So Magnus. Crime rates have been at historic lows. I think people are kind of surprised sometimes to learn that. But in 2015, there was an uptick in the crime rate. Is this an aberration or the beginning of a trend?
Well, I think, you know, we need to recognize that the crime rates do fluctuate from year to year, and there are a number of reasons behind that. I mean, if there are changes in gang activity, drug markets, economic and social factors, they all, you know, impact crime rates. And also, how and for how long we decide to incarcerate offenders and what kind of experience they have while incarcerated, those are also factors that could affect public safety. We are on a long-term decline in crime in California and the nation as a whole. In California, property crime rates have been coming down since, on a long-term trend, since 1980, mm-hmm. and violent crime since 1990. We saw upticks in 2012, down in 2013, 14, and as you mentioned, 2015.
Yeah, so the property crimes are going up a little bit in particular.
Well, what we see in 2015 is exactly that. Property crime went up by about 6.6%, but violent crime went up by about 8.4%, a little bit larger. But here's the thing there. We saw a national trend as well.
So it wasn't just California.
It wasn't just California. In fact, there were about 10 other states that saw at least as big of an increase in violent crime as we saw here.
We've only about 30 seconds left, but I want to get this in. What do you think needs to be done to maintain the progress that's been happening so far when it comes to corrections, and how do we overcome the challenges?
Well, I think one big thing is to address the high recidivism rates that we have in California, and one way to do that is to increasingly use evidence-based practices to identify the right kind of programming and services that are needed. We need to look at what the counties, their resources, do they have the right resources to actually implement and deal with these challenges the state have passed on to them, and make sure that public safety is not on an upward that it's being
We'll be
changed.
Watching. Yeah. We'll be watching. Well, I want to thank Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin from the PPIC for joining us. I also want to thank Sarah Bowen, Alvar Esquerria, Bo, and Paul Warren from the PPIC also for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can sign up for our award-winning e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or The Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.